Earth and Sky.
Over the recent 30, 40, 50 years, geographic isolation has been the dominant recognized way that you get new species. You isolate populations and run evolution long enough and they'll become different.
You're listening to Christopher Raxworthy of the American Museum of Natural History in New York, and this is Earth Sky's Clear Voices for Science. Dr. Raxworthy works in a branch of zoology dealing with reptiles and amphibians. He uses genetic data and data collected by satellites orbiting Earth. His work might help revolutionize our understanding of how evolution works. He spoke with EarthSky's Beth Lebwohl.
When did you actually start the process of using satellite data to find where new chameleons might be?
So I started looking at the satellite data in around 2001, 2002.
And which satellite are we talking about?
So initially we were using things like MODIS layers and also Landsat, SPOT.
So you used a whole bunch of satellite data.
That's right. So as this satellite data became more and more available, it was actually possible to create these layers, these environmental layers for Madagascar, where we could look at elevation and the temperature data to actually fill in all the missing gaps, which are substantial in Madagascar, is really important. We can then use algorithms which will actually search for correlations between those different variables and the occurrence of the species of chameleon. This is a process which is called distribution modeling. And essentially, the algorithm looks for correlations and actually builds a probability map for across the landscape of Madagascar, what sort of probability there is that the species could actually occur there. For anywhere from 100%, in other words, all the conditions are absolutely perfect for chameleons, all the way down to zero.
How many new species of chameleons have you actually found?
I've been working in Madagascar for 25 years. Over a period of 25 years, I have in the order of about 20 new species of chameleon. And so far, I've described about half of those, but there are more species at the moment which are descriptions which are in progress. And one of the things we're doing now, we're using satellite data and distribution modeling and genetic data, plus also traditional morphological characters, to see if we can actually recognize cryptic species. These are species which have been overlooked in the past. They're difficult to detect. You know, if you saw species A and species B, they would look so similar. You would think, well, you know, are they different species? Is this just geographic variation? But by using a combination of genetic data and distribution modeling techniques, it's actually possible now to come up with a more refined picture of these cryptic, difficult-to-detect species.
What do cryptic species show you about evolution, things like that?
Well, the cool thing about cryptic species is that because there's much less time that's elapsed since they've speciated, it gives us a much more accurate picture about what might be driving speciation. You know, you can imagine a species pair which are maybe 5 million years old. There's an awful lot of time which has passed since they speciated, so they've been shifting around in Madagascar. Maybe another species went extinct. Maybe there's been some range collapse. There's been a lot of evolution since they were isolated from each other. But if we go to the very most recent speciation events, we can start to see, for example, maybe there are landscape features like rivers or mountains that have helped to isolate them. Or we can actually see whether they have evolved very much over that very short period of time. You know, maybe their colorations and their morphology are very similar, but they've actually, over a very short period of time, adapted to very different habitats. So it allows us to actually see evolution in action over shorter time periods. Particularly for trying to understand what's driving speciation, the younger speciation events are going to be the most informative because essentially they have much less noise in the system.
Can you give a couple of specific examples?
Yeah. So, for example, we have an interesting group of lined chameleons in Madagascar. They have lines on their bellies. And at the moment, there's just a single species in Madagascar that's recognized and it's found pretty much everywhere in Madagascar, which is incredible. There are so few species that are distributed broadly across the island because the island is so varied. You have deserts, you have humid rainforests, tops of high mountains. So a species that is adapted to all those different habitats is almost unheard of. Now, what we're actually finding is we start to look at the genetic data and we start using distribution modeling techniques is that in this particular case, it's actually a complex of multiple species. Their morphology is very similar. That's why they're cryptic. They have been overlooked in the past. But for example, the desert species, the species that lives in the driest conditions, is actually the largest. And that's really interesting in and of itself. You know, why would you start to get large in an arid environment? And we think that might be linked to during the dry season, they actually have to estivate, which is like a hibernation only at high temperatures. And they're very vulnerable to desiccation. And in these really dry forests, you actually don't get these really tiny chameleons that you find in some other areas of Madagascar. So my guess is, for example, in this case, that if you're going to live in these deserts, you have to get bigger to stop yourself from drying out. That's a hypothesis that's waiting to be tested. But now suddenly we can start to actually look at that speciation event about this ancestral chameleon penetrating these really dry environments and adapting and becoming larger to help it get through the dry season, for example. I predict within a few years, we'll actually have a much clearer picture about actually what's driving the process of speciation, particularly in tropical areas. And that's actually a really, as I said, is a really profound question. We still have such a poor understanding about processes of speciation. And there are two very different models of speciation, which at the moment, as biologists, we're grappling with trying to understand, you know, which is the dominant form. So I think the prospects are very good that within the next 5 to 10 years, we'll finally have answered the speciation question in a much more satisfying fashion than what's possible at the moment.
Well, just looking at your research or considering your own research, what is it that you feel is driving speciation?
It's complex. I think that there is no single model. So we're not going to find this magic silver bullet of just like this is the answer. But and the interesting thing is that over the recent 30, 40, 50 years, geographic isolation has been the dominant recognized way that you get new species. You isolate populations and run evolution long enough and they'll become different. But what I'm seeing in Madagascar is a process where you don't necessarily have to have geographic isolation to actually drive speciation, that different populations can adapt to different environmental gradients, and you can actually get speciation occurring with gene flow. And that's actually still a relatively radical idea.
I don't know what you mean by gradients and gene flow.
Okay. So gene flow is the exchange of genetic information between populations. So it basically means an individual crossing with another individual. And that would be examples of gene flow, genetic information flowing between different populations. And environmental gradients, what I'm talking about there is, say, a rainfall gradient or a temperature gradient or an elevation gradient. All these variables that we look on the landscape of Madagascar, we see rather than a static landscape in the sense that for large areas it's very constant, we tend to find gradients consistently. So as you go up a mountain or you go from a desert to a humid rainforest, that those are environmental gradients. What we're tending to find is that we have some species that where the they span these environmental gradients and different populations are adapting to different local conditions. But they're not actually adapting in a way which suggests that they have to be isolated from each other. You can actually get local adaptation with gene flow.
Okay, got it. So let me ask you a final question. What is the most important thing that you'd like to tell Earth Sky's global audience about your work on chameleons?
The key thing is that we have a lot more unrecognized diversity in chameleons in Madagascar than was known 20 or 30 years ago due to both field work and discovery of new species, plus now using all these new techniques, satellite data and genetic data to help recognize diversity. That's fantastic in terms of it really helps us with evolution, but it also creates that much extra pressure on us to actually really make smart conservation decisions. We can't just take a few reserves and just say, well, that's it. We've got all the diversity. We need now a much more complex conservation program in place to actually ensure that we maintain all that biological diversity for the future.
You've been listening to Christopher Raxworthy at the American Museum of Natural History in New York. Our thanks today to NASA's Terra mission, helping us better understand and protect our home planet. To subscribe to this and other free science interview podcasts, visit the subscribe page at earthsky.org. I'm Deborah Bird. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.